I think Gore Vidal said once that, like, there's not a single problem in the world that couldn't be solved if everyone thought the way that I did.
All right, welcome to another episode of Increments. Vaden, if the U.S. descends into civil war, are we going to keep doing these podcasts?
Yeah, in like a bunker underground somewhere with a shotgun and a beer. Things are pretty hairy right now, man. How are you holding up in the in California? If the fires aren't going to kill you, the polarization might.
Yeah, seriously. Fires, COVID, Trump. I don't know what's happening over here.
Don't go outside, man. Yeah.
Okay, so what the hell are we actually talking about today? So doing the chapter on public opinion, the myth of public opinion, it's called, in Conjectures of Refutation. So continuing on that series, this is a little bit different than the other chapters, especially the traditions one, where we did a little bit of a closer reading of the text. But this one, the goal of the chapter is basically just to promote discussion and give people a bunch of prompts from which to work. And so we don't refer to the text that often. We basically just like take some of the questions he offers as initial discussion bullets. Yeah. And then we just run with it. And so, it's a pretty fun episode. We have some fun chats. I don't know if there's much to say. Yeah.
Just that people should read the chapter themselves, but don't think that we have covered it exhaustively. The next one coming down the tubes on the difference between prediction and prophecy, we go back to the close read style. So we're still iterating to try to figure out what kind of style we're going to stick with, but probably neither, just go with the flow. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. It's a good combo. So let's roll the tape. You had said on Messenger that you had noticed a interesting, say, relationship between the effective altruist way of thinking and reactionary politics. And I would just love to hear more about that, as would our listeners, I'm sure. Yeah. And so what have you noticed, my friend?
Okay, so this is a thesis that's in development. It's just some strands of popular culture that I've started to weave together into some semi-coherent thoughts. But it actually starts not with EA, but just with the left itself right now. And so maybe we can just start more political and then go towards EA. Later on, but I'd love to get your reaction to the following thought, which is that there is an interesting convergence right now, I think, between ideologues on the left and the right. So I think people are very familiar with reactionary politics as it's typically viewed via the lens of like Burkean conservatism, right? So here you're very skeptical of innovation. You're skeptical of new ways of perhaps governing. You're skeptical of new technologies because you're scared of the disruption to the status quo. And this gets to what we were talking about in the episode on traditions, right? You're very pro-tradition. You think tradition encapsulates a lot of the wisdom that we've been able to grow over time. And so you're scared in to disrupt tradition too drastically, lest it lead to horrific consequences. Okay, so I think people would generally acknowledge that this sort of favoritism for the status quo and reactionary type thinking is very prominent among the right. At least this is even how we're taught about sort of the difference between the left and right in like high school or something, when we start learning about the political spectrum. But what I begin to notice is this reactionary strain of thinking is becoming more and more prominent in the far left as well, where, and it's perhaps for different reasons, but I think there's equally like a skepticism towards new technology, new solutions, because things are viewed mostly as like power games and people putting forth new ideas, whether it be in the technological sphere, the political sphere. These people are often like influential in various ways, and thereby have some power, right? And so they're viewed with skepticism by people on the left who are very skeptical of hierarchy in any form, right? And so, And so this is not to say that they are also okay with the status quo. They're also very anti-status quo, right? So they do want to change things, but it's like they're not okay with the status quo, but they're also not okay with any of the proposals being made to change it, right? Unless, and this is the key thing, unless it has to do with just literally tearing everything down, right? So that's the kind of change that I think is often viewed positively, and the only kind of change that's viewed positively among certain subsets of the left right now. So it's like, we need to discard everything because everything is rotten. Everything is built upon a rotten foundation of exploitation and, you know, capitalism and evil power games between different groups of people, and we need to tear it all down and build a utopia from the ground up. Putting aside that they often can't agree on what utopia looks like or give any sort of coherent framework to what that idea is. But so it's almost as if solution like gradualism and marginal solutions are like dirty words to sort of this subset of people, right? Like they don't want small reforms that incrementally work towards betterment, right? They view this as like, no, this is people maintaining the status quo. This is people paying lip service to change while they're just trying to maintain power. And so they view all of these suggestions for how to change things, right? For how to work within the current system to bring about change with like utmost suspicion. And so what this does is bizarrely end up aligning them with people who are afraid of change on the right. Right. And these two groups, the far left and the far right, you know, they despise each other, right? They're almost defined in opposition to one another. And yet they share this antipathy towards any new innovation, any suggestion coming out of whether it's the tech community, whether it's the centrists, right? For both of these people, centrists it's just a dirty word, right? It's like people who have no ideological commitment, who can't see the manifest truth in front of them. And so anyway, I've just been, so again, like it's not always for the same reasons. Like the right might favor the status quo and the left is often skeptical of it, but I've just started to notice this tendency to view any reforms, any form of change that works at all from inside the system as just fundamentally rotten, right? Just because the people who are proposing it obviously must be in it for their own gain and they don't actually care about anything going on. And so the only solution here is to tear down the system from its roots and rebuild. And so anyway, I've just found this so fascinating because these groups are so opposed in multiple ways of thinking, but it's all almost because they're, it's like they hate each other so much. They've converged in this weird realm of just being suspicious towards any form of change. And again, for different reasons. But so anyway, yeah. I'm just curious to know what your reactions are.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've heard it called the horseshoe theory of politics, where when you get further to the left and the right, the ends bend up and meet each other and form a horseshoe. And so I've heard this thesis in different forms before, more on the like left-wing and right-wing totalitarianisms tend to look quite similar.
Right, yeah.
But the reactionary bit is new to me. So I want to dive into that a tiny bit because I wasn't super familiar with the phrase reactionary. And thinking about it a bit more, it's like when I think of the far right, I tend to think like fascism, or like tiki torch, wielding neo-Nazi goons.
Right.
But then I guess there's this other kind of far rightism, which is like wanting to preserve the status quo, like you said. And so it's almost like the Amish kind of far right, where they want to just like keep everything as it was in like the 1700s with like making their own milk and churning their own butter. And that is, I guess, a kind of extreme right wing, right tendency, but it's very different than the fascism tendency. I see a bit of a dissimilarity in the sense that the burn it all down folk want progress, but they want progress by destruction, basically.
Yeah.
So it's like, first, if we want to make a new hospital, first we have to destroy the old one. And they're focused on the destruction of the existing status quo in order to get progress. Where in the reactionary types don't want progress at all, and therefore don't want to do anything new. Then the similarity, which you identify, is that both of them are going to be against incremental improvements. Anybody who wants to improve the existing hospital is going to be seen as an enemy by both of these sides. Even though their aims are quite different, the way that they think about incremental progress is quite the same. And in that thesis, I completely believe, if that's a proper grammatical sentence. I totally. And this is a huge problem because if you're like myself and presumably you, who are more centrist, then you essentially have a two-front war, right? You have you have twice as many ideological opponents as you would if you are on one of these far extremes, and it is it's tough out there for an incrementalist, I guess, because when you want to propose positive change and propose solutions to existing problems, you are met by both sides who say, like, what the hell are you doing? And so I completely agree with this thesis. And I guess my question is, like, what contemporary examples or what is it that you've noticed recently in your life that has caused you to propose this thesis? Because I think it's spot on and I totally agree. And it's something I've been, frankly, worried about and concerned about since I was maybe 21. And I could tell a personal story later, which will get us closer to the subject at hand, which is like public opinion and stuff. But I'm just curious what you've noticed recently that has led you to these thoughts.
Yeah, so it was, I've been interested in the links between the left and the right and the roots of their thinking ever since basically moving to the US, because one, especially in the liberal bubble in which that I inhabit in California, one is never far from the opinion that like everyone on the right is a fascist, right? like if you have any sort of right leaning tendencies, you are a fascist or have been taken by fascist ideas, right? And then similarly, you know, if you're in other parts of the country and you subscribe to any sort of left-leaning ideology, you are a communist, right? And so you just get this complete binary, very
quickly
intellectual. It just seems devoid to me of like actually engaging with the kind of arguments being put forward by people. It's just like you label people you disagree with as fascists and conversation over. But anyway, so this got me thinking of like, what are the roots of these camps and whatnot? And then, you know, we started talking about certain things that I was hearing in pop culture, like prison abolition and police abolition. And then one thing I started to realize is like, wait a second, you know, part of the prison abolition rhetoric is grounded in conservative ideology, right? Because it's a callback to communities wanting to govern themselves. I should say at this point, I'm very agnostic as to whether like prison or police abolition is a good idea. I think it's definitely time for some societal experiments where we try different policing regimens and whatnot, because obviously the status quo is not working. But anyway, like, you know, there's a group of people who are like putting a lot of ideas out there about how to live without police and prisons and whatnot, and these people typically are associated with the far left, or at least a certain strand of the left. But as you know, as I started reading the pieces and listening to the spokespeople, I started to realize that, you know, this sort of idea of like community autonomy, not being beholden to the state, taking power back from the state, this is precisely the origins of conservative ideology, right? They want self-governance of community, and they don't want lots of state intervention. They want to be able to make local decisions that affect their lives, and they want local communities to be able to do this themselves without intervention from a big top-down monolithic government. And so this just got me thinking about like, wait, there's some connections here. But like as much as these camps hate each other and would never admit that any of their favored political solutions or ideology stems at all from the from the other side of the aisle, God forbid, you know, and yet I think they share a lot in common when you start actually tearing apart the arguments. So this just got me thinking, like, are there other commonalities? You know, what's happening here? And then this is just sort of one of the strands that I started to notice as, like, there's more and more pieces about, you know, anti-business, anti-tech, like, what, you know, like, modernity sucks, like, you know, we haven't made any progress, all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it has me thinking about two things. There's the Freudian notion of the narcissism of small differences. Have you heard this one? It's like, if you take two groups of people who, from an outsider's perspective, are almost indistinguishable, they'll make the absolute maximum out of the absolute minimum.
Right.
So it's the Hutus and the Tutsis, or the Sunni and the Shia, or the Catholic and the Protestant, or the Republicans and the Democrats. And what's interesting is that groups that tend to hate each other are both so similar. And also, what they hate about other people are the tiny, tiny differences. And so the fact that both of these, say, political parties and political movements have a desire to go back to how things were before. So in the reactionary case, it's to a time when family values and Christian values were dominant. But in the left-wing case, it's before the stain of colonialism and white supremacy had blotted the lands. But both of them want to go back to some time before. But they don't recognize that, the similarity. They only recognize the differences. And so I think it's a deep truth. And it makes me... So this is the second thought that occurred to me as you were speaking, that perhaps it's almost like human nature, where it might not be that it's just the left and the right, but it might just be that humans desire this, and it's going to manifest itself in different ways. But there is this, like, idea of, like, the noble savage or whatever, where things in the past were so much better than things today.
Right.
And another, like, similarity that I've noticed recently is this, like, this idea of original sin, that, like, we are guilty by definition of who we are and that we are alive. We are guilty. The only time that there wasn't sin and shame was, say, Adam and Eve, or before the United States was founded. There's the original sin of skin color, or the original sin of being a Catholic. And John McWhorter is developing this thesis in his upcoming book about anti-racism and its similarities with religion. So there's a lot of these parallels that can be drawn. It then begs the question, like, what does one do with this? It's not, I guess, enough just to notice it, but how do we go forward when we have views on the left and the right that are basically trying to prevent us from going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would really help to be able to divorce political ideals from identity, or maybe, to put it in a slightly less confusing way, to view political ideals as conjectures independent from whoever's proposing them, or independent from a side of the aisle, for example. So we, you know, there's some group of people who has an idea about how we could live better, right? And then we want to, insofar as it's feasible, to, like, test this idea or analyze it critically and rigorously without attaching their identities to the idea. Because I think as soon as your identity becomes intertwined with a political ideal, then we get in all sorts of trouble, right? Then it doesn't become about the actual consequences of achieving such an ideal, right? It becomes about us versus them, those who hold that ideal versus those who don't, right? As opposed to just, like, an idea, right, that people are putting out there versus and then another people who are initially opposed to that idea, but we say, like, you know, we just have to acknowledge our ignorance. Like, we don't know, right? Like, you know, if you're going to tell me I know for sure that police abolition is a good or bad idea, that just it seems absurd to me, right? Like, you know, you can give me your best argument right now, but it has to remain a fact that we don't know. And if you're unwilling to acknowledge that, then that's the most dangerous tendency, I think, in political dialogue right now, is the unwillingness to admit that your political ideal might actually do more harm than good, right? So if we were able to sort of divorce people from their ideas,
I think
that would go a long way to helping us start to just, you know, view progress as like a bunch of ideas, and then we try them and see what works.
I realized, like, up until right now, I was seeing this as quite a negative, pessimistic thing. Like, why can't everyone just think like I do? Like, I think Gore Vidal said once that, like, there's not a single problem in the world that couldn't be solved if everyone thought the way that I did. and how nice that would be, you know? But I realized I had a bit of a pessimistic view on that, but you could see it optimistically as well, which is that your side isn't any better than the other side.
Right.
And us on our side are making similar mistakes to those on that side. And therefore, we have twice as many people who we can talk to because our team is just as mistake prone as the other team, and therefore maybe teams don't make as much sense as we thought they would did,
right?
You know, one of my closest friends on the planet is a Republican, and he grew up in Memphis. When him and I met, we met at a music festival some many years ago. He was the first Republican that I had met, and I believe Helena and I were the first Canadians that that he had met. Immediately we realized that this boogeyman that we had made of the other side, like, was just not true. It was just not true. People who vote differently than I do have the same general concerns. They're interested in improving the lives of their friends and family, and they want to make the world around them better. They just have a different view about how best to do that. And so through discussion with people who are dissimilar from yourself, but also so bloody similar to yourself as to make you want to hate them, as the case of the narcissism of small differences kind of highlights, are so valuable to talk to. And so perhaps that is an optimistic spin, an optimistic perspective we could have on this fact that the left and the right tend to be very similar. But I wanted to pivot the conversation ever so slightly, because the topic of today is public opinion and how powerful a force it is. So I don't think we're going to go into the chapter in as much detail as we did the traditions chapter, but the thesis that you proposed is, I think, so relevant to this, because there are these huge dueling opinions out there, dueling ideas that are very hard to stand up against, hard to think clearly in the midst of, because you're constantly surrounded, say, by people who are telling you you have to burn it all down and telling you that the other guys are the enemy. And it takes a lot of, like, fortitude to resist this public force, I guess. And so
I just give in, man.
feels
so good.
Yeah.
But give in.
I'm seeing a bit of that in your comments, which is that everyone that you're currently surrounded by in California, if this isn't too much of a caricature, is roughly pushing in this one direction of burn it down. Is that accurate? Am I being a bit coarse there?
No. Or? Well, it's a larger proportion of people than I would have thought before showing up. I think perhaps I just lived in places that were more equally divided, or at least less perhaps politically engaged even than what I'm seeing here. So I definitely have a larger proportion of friends who are of the burn it down types, but I think just because I'm so always fascinated by, like, beliefs and how people form beliefs, that my attention can't help but be captured by these kinds of people, and then it ends up dominating my thoughts, right? And so I'm going to bed every night thinking about burning it all down and what that would mean and whether they're justified in their beliefs and how they can know this would work and things like that. So it's, you know, it's part of the political landscape, but it's also just part of my personality. I'm always just fascinated by people who have, like, very strong beliefs in a certain direction, and always so it probably sounds like I'm just, you know, every 99% of my friends are just want to tear down the system.
So that's what's interesting. So I love people who have very strong beliefs. I learn so much from them. You are an excellent example of someone who, like, I learned so much from, because I will say something and you will digest it, and if it is wrong in any way, you're going to call me out on it. So I love that. But there's a big difference between people who have strong beliefs, which are unique and individual and new and represent fresh perspectives, like Christopher Hitchens is a good example of that. And people who all have very strong beliefs that are roughly exchangeable. I could take belief from person number one and put it into belief from person number two, and you roughly hear the same thing.
Right.
And that is troubling to me when people have strong beliefs, but it's almost like you could take their utterances and run it through a anti-plagiarism software, and it would just start binging because what they say is the exact same thing as what 15 other people around them say. And that's where you start getting strong beliefs becoming public opinion, I think, because the beliefs are all essentially univocal. It's like they're the same belief said in the mouths of many different people. That I find to be very troubling and very prominent right now. It's maybe because I'm just on the West Coast in Vancouver and very liberal bubbles, and I see most people on Instagram posting roughly the same set of views, that I'm worried about this. But it's strong beliefs that seem to be exchangeable is what I fear, because there is this like comfort of the crowd thing, where people feel very emboldened to speak strongly when they know they have the mob behind them. And that's very different than having a strong view that either cuts orthogonal to the voices of the many, or having a strong view which is just completely different from other people's. And so how much of that do you notice in California?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it's pretty issue dependent almost. So, for example, there are very few people on the coast in California which would be an open Trump supporter, for example. So there's complete cohesion around that point where I'm living. Similarly with the idea of like defunding the police, which is slightly more worrying to me, right? Like, I think most people were on board with that idea. And I'm not saying that idea is wrong. I'm precisely saying I don't know whether that will help. And there's like communities of people who are suffering terribly. And so we need to, I mean, maybe we should pause and say, like, you know, why do both of us probably value diversity of opinion? It's precisely because truth is hard to come by. And we're not sure what's right. We're not sure what's going to work. I shouldn't speak for you. I guess I should, you know, this is why I value diversity of opinion. But, it's hard to know what's going to work at the outset. And so having as many ideas out there as possible, as many people critically analyzing different ideas as possible, is valuable, because then we're going to, ideally, if we have a robust enough process, we're going to end up with the best idea at the end of the day, right? And that's how we make progress. It's like we just slowly come up with better and better ideas. And so if you have a monolith of voices around any issue whatsoever, it's worrying, even if that idea is right, because if there's not enough people criticizing it, the best version of that idea probably won't be put out there, right? Like if there's substantial pushback against an idea, forces proponents of that idea to develop the best version of it, right? So it's even in the interest of people holding a specific political or moral position to have opposition, right? Because it forces them to come up with like, whoa, okay, let's, you know, if it's an empirical question, let's look at the data again, you know, because I need to show that this is valid, or I need to go back to first principles and reason my way to truth here. And so that's the reason why I think we're both arguing for diversity of opinion.
You could totally speak for me on that point. That is exactly spot on. 100%. I agree. Yeah. So ironically, we have the exact same view.
Exactly.
The importance of
having
different
diversity of opinion.
Yeah. Anyways, continue.
Yeah. But I would say that is very worrying, especially in the US at the moment. I think things are so polarized at the level of federal politics that, and I mean, it's not like the system encourages it to be otherwise. You have this like two-party system, and you gotta vote for one of them, otherwise your vote doesn't count. Like, sorry, independents, but it's, you know, it's not gonna cut it. And this forces group thinking at the political level, and does not encourage any sort of diversity of opinion at that. So I think that's a big, I think you have this bizarre feedback effect where the two-party political system reinforces this like two-pronged national identity, where you're like either on the right or the left, and that then reinforces federal politics, and then we just get this bizarre feedback effect whereby people are just like increasingly polarized and increasingly pushed towards opposite ends of the spectrum.
So in this chapter, but just basically throughout Popper's work, he talks about democracy and what it's good for. And I think you and I have talked about this before, either online or offline, but how it's about removing leaders without bloodshed, without violence. And I'm not going to talk about that too much, but one of the consequences of that view is that Popper is very much in favor of the first past the post two-party system as the least worst option. And so it's an interesting thing because the two-party polarization, with all of its problems, it encourages groupthink. It encourages tribalism, polarization. It does, but it also is a very good mechanism of generating criticism. Because when you hate the other guys, the best way to try to take them down without violence is to come up with good arguments that will destroy their views. And whether or not it's done for the pursuit of truth or done just because you hate them, it is still a mechanism to come up with arguments. And what I wanted to say is that there's almost like a, in like special relativity, the frame of reference, like whenever, at whatever speed you're traveling, it never seems like you're going anywhere. It feels always stationary. And so we always feel like we're stuck in the same arguments, but we actually are making progress. It's just we have to take a wider lens at it. We have to not view it in 4-year cycles or 8-year cycles, but in 50-year cycles. And I find it quite useful sometimes to think about all of those things that we just aren't arguing about anymore. For example, like libertarian arguments against seatbelts tend not to be made, but I think that they actually were made when there's like a big seatbelt debate about whether or not it was just like a horrible infringement on our civil liberties to be told what to do when we're in cars, or to be told what speed to travel at when we're driving on the highway, or even gay rights would be the most recent example of this, where Trump, for all of his faults, doesn't really seem interested in this issue. And it's like the wave has just moved past it. And it seems like the progress that has been made on that front is not going to be lost. And so despite all of the problems with polarization and stuff, I noticed that if you zoom out a little bit, you can see that this progress is still taking place. There's debates and arguments, and then like people argue about and then the next cycle, 95% of the legislation put in place by the previous guys is undone, but 5% remains. And then the argument moves forward, and then another 5% remains. And in this way, you like I think even the first environmental protection was put in place by either Reagan or Nixon, a Republican president, because at the time it was seen as like I want to protect the environments because I like to go hunting.
And yeah, exactly. It was people, I think, who wanted to like duck hunt in the South or something, and they wanted to keep their land for duck hunting. Yeah.
and so like the conversation keeps moving on and stuff, but you do get some progress being made. And I find that useful to think about when it feels as if like we're just constantly arguing and the polarization is constantly increasing and stuff. There is still this notion of argument generation and progress, despite the tumult.
Yeah. So I'm curious what you do with the following. So I've heard this a number of times where a progressive will say, look, throughout history, most of the direction we've moved in has been that direction advocated by the left. So, for example, like giving women and minorities the vote, legalizing gay marriage, not in every country now, but legalizing abortion, so moving more towards just like inclusivity, impartiality, these sort of values. These are typically the values espoused by the left. And this, or if you take a, like, a long view of history, this is kind of the direction we've moved in. And so we should be very skeptical of the right precisely because they've sort of been on the wrong side of history more often than not. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering, like, what do you think about that argument?
Yeah. I think that it's so interesting that people say that, because I think it's so incorrect. Like, I see both sides as needing one another, where the progressives will make progress and then the conservatives will maintain it. Because a lot of the things which conservative thought, rightly celebrates about our culture, it's the emancipation of women, the freedom to say start your own entrepreneurial venture and then become quite successful. Mm-hmm. Civil liberties in comparison to other times in history. A lot of those things which conservative thinking tends to celebrate was achieved by liberals a generation or two previously. Right. The United States Constitution was very much informed by Thomas Jefferson, who is one of the most the first progressive thinkers, and so to those who say that the conservatives have always been on the wrong side of history, I just ask, who is it that you expect to hold on to the progress that you make a couple of generations in the future? Because progressives are always going to be wanting to push things forward, which is excellent. But once we make progress, hopefully we want to keep it and celebrate it and be proud of it. And so to flip the question on its head, that, like, I don't understand the progressive view that just wants to destroy our own society. Because how can one simultaneously believe in progress and think we've made none of it since the 1700s, or even going back further? And so the similarities between these two sides, you described in the beginning of the conversation, I think is paralleled by the fact that the two sides in some sense need each other, and they both represent two aspects of what's necessary to make and keep progress.
One thing from earlier I'd be interested in pushing back on a little bit, or at least could see someone pushing back on, is I think earlier we sort of made it out to seem that, like, everyone has the same underlying values and that the left and the right are simply different manifestations of ideas of how to get to those values, how best to achieve them. But I think it's right to argue sometimes that there's just separate underlying values, right? Like, those on the right tend to value local community much more, sticking close to home, heritage and tradition. Those on the left traditionally are more interested in cosmopolitanism, opening up the borders, having people migrate between different cities, different areas of the planet, sharing of ideas and knowledge along these fronts. And so, well, while arguments often do center around, like, the different ways to actually just achieve better outcomes, right? Like, we all want to see less African Americans murdered by police, of course. There's also at oftentimes just different underlying values at stake. And so I think a lot of those listening to us, especially at the beginning, I can just imagine my left-leaning friends screaming, like, no, you have this all wrong, because it's not about trying to come up with the best ways to achieve certain ideals. It's those very ideals that are at stake. It's a battleground over what sort of society we want to live in, right? Whether we want it to be close to foreigners and dominated by a certain ethnic group or whatnot, and so on and so forth.
I think there's obviously a lot of truth in that. Like, the example that comes to mind most quickly is the abortion debate, like pro-choice or pro-life. Do you value the women's right to autonomy over their body or do you value the life of the unborn fetus? But the other thing that's going on is that there's a assuming the values of the other guys that doesn't necessarily have to be accurate. So for example, with the abortion debate, I think that what I just said is a bit of a caricature and a straw man of both sides, because I think both sides value life, and I think both sides value choice. And really what's going on is that there's a different shift in emphasis. And if I, obviously I'm very much pro-choice, of course, but let's say I was pro-choice and I believed for some other reason that like a blastocyst was alive, that had the exact same moral significance as an 18-year-old or someone who is born 500 years in the future, as the long-termists tend to focus on. If I thought that, as which I don't, but if I did, then that would complicate my worldview quite a lot, right? And so to step away from the abortion example and go back to the general case, I think that in many situations, both sides have similar and overlapping values, but they have different worldviews about how to achieve these values and how to best trade off between different values. And also, when people talk about values, there's this, I think, like implicit assumption that values are immutable. Values are unchangeable. You can't change someone's values. Like if you and I agree on X, Y, and Z, that's fine, but we have to make sure we have the same values. Otherwise, there's just no way we can talk to one another. And I think that's also incorrect. Like values are, at the end of the day, informed by what you think is true, by the people around you. My values have shifted just in the last couple of years, where in my 20s, I was like valuing travel much more than I temporarily am now. Like, so right now, I'm valuing, say, starting a podcast with you and valuing trying to get my career going. And so values don't necessarily have to be fixed and immutable. They too are open to changing, to criticism, to being updated through conversation. And so I think that we can get ourselves into trouble by assuming that you meet someone and they say something that indicates they may be pro-life. And then you think, holy shit, they have different values than me. There's just no way I can possibly communicate with them or talk to them. No, of course not. No, ask them to explain themselves and see where you agree. See where you, see why they have this view. Perhaps it's because they're, deeply concerned with like third trimester abortions. And I care about third trimester abortions too. I think I start to get quite squeamish at that point. And maybe you have much more in common than you thought. And so, to those who say, yes, debate and discussion is all fine and good, assuming you're talking to someone with similar values, I say to them, don't make that assumption. Assume that your values are going to be similar and different to everyone you speak to, and everyone is open to both having their mind changed and changing your mind, and don't limit conversation to only those with whom you share values, because that's quite limiting.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's good. The possible updating of values via conversation is, I think, something we just don't acknowledge enough, right? Like, people change their minds, and they change their minds based on arguments.
And like, my values have changed. And, like, I think I heard Paul Bloom say that his values changed almost entirely when he had kids. And I am anticipating that when I have children, like, a lot of my values are going to change. And right. Presumably, other life events will change your values as well. And like, people tend to switch political parties throughout their lives, go from the left to the right, go from the right to the left, as like, say, David Frum has done. And so there's nothing, I think, intrinsically that separates us, even values. Values are just one of many things which are subject to updating.
Are you going to stop podcasting when you have kids?
No. Oh, God, no. No, I'll do like what is it the Very Bad Wizards have done, where they just get their daughter or one of their daughters to do the intro. So we'll just bring their kids.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Bring our kids on. But so, okay, here's a question for you. So on the subject of public opinion, I had a conversation with a friend of mine a couple days ago, or maybe about a week ago. And he said something very striking, which wasn't meant to be significant, but just based on what I knew we'd be talking about today, it stood out. And he said that he's very distrustful of contrarian views. And I guess I'm I've been very influenced by contrarian thinkers throughout my entire life. Like Christopher Hitchens was one of the first people who had a huge impact on me. But then I've sought out contrarians and those who try to stand up against public opinion. And so I guess I'm curious what your thoughts are on contrarianism and taking a stand against, say, public opinion, wherever it may be. If you think it's just sensational and attention grabbing, as I think some people tend to view it, or if you think that there's like a role for this, or if you think it's dangerous, because some people may say, well, yeah, the Richard Spencer, he could be seen as a contrarian, but obviously his views are revolting. And so what are your thoughts on contrarianism and if it's a worthwhile or valuable thing or not?
Yeah, until you gave that last example, I thought my position was quite straightforward, but now I'm realizing there's a little bit of a thorn that I'm not sure how to deal with. So my initial reaction was basically what I said earlier, right? Contrarianism is valuable insofar as it exposes us to varieties of a certain idea or just different ideas entirely, because ideas are how we make progress. We want a lot of ideas out there, so we have as many possible options about how to improve society and people's welfare as possible moving forward. But it's dodging the question a bit, right? Because there's the question of platforms and like to what extent you give contrarian speakers and thinkers platforms, right? And that's something I've never known. I've always been like pretty uncomfortable thinking about that space, because on one hand, you can think of like status quos in the past that were absolutely horrendous, right? Think of when we were like burning women because we were convinced they were witches, right? This is not a status quo that anyone wants to uphold now. And a contrarian voice at that point would have been incredibly valuable until I got burned for being a witch. But you don't want to like set a distance from the status quo at which a contrarian ceases to be valuable, because some aspects of the status quo are so horrendous that we need contrarian voices to speak out against it. And as much as I don't know what to think about prison and police abolition, I think it's absolutely fantastic that there are people in the political sphere right now arguing along those lines. I think that's just incredibly valuable, right? Like it reminds us that even certain very ingrained aspects of our society aren't to be taken for granted, right? And if we want to continue having police and prisons, we need to be sure that they're actually the best solution to our problem. But do you want to give every contrarian a voice in the public sphere? Like, I really don't know. I don't think anyone with a decent conscience would argue that, like, Spencer's arguments are just abhorrent, right? And so do you want to give him public platforms? I'm not sure. Do you want to allow him to speak at schools? I don't know. So, yeah, I'm confused. So persuade me one way or the other.
Yeah, well, so I think the question of public platforms is a separate issue. Like there's obviously the deplatforming trend, and I think that's quite dangerous because we don't know in advance who the Richard Spencers are and who the like Ayaan Hirsi Ali's are, who was also say deplatformed at Brandeis University. And so this trend, similar to the statues trend, is I think more about just mob mentalities and public panic than it is about the pursuit of truth and justice. So I'm very much against deplatforming, but that's not exactly the same question as whether or not it's a good idea to platform in the first place. Right. So should Richard Spencer be given a microphone from, say, the University of British Columbia? Probably not. But if somebody wants to and is willing to pay for it and have him there, then I think he should absolutely have a right to speak. And we as audience members have a right to destroy his arguments. What are we so scared of? Do we think that we're not going to be able to argue against white supremacy when it shows its face? Of course we are. It's trivial to argue against this. If in fact it's hard to argue against, then we have some work to do on our side to understand just what is it about our values, to use that word again, that is so worth defending. And this is what Hitchens said in his amazing Fire, Fire, Fire speech, which is like, if there's one voice who says, how do you know that the world is round and not flat? This person has not only a right to speak, but they must speak. And their speaking is not only on their behalf, but on the behalf of the speaker, but it's on the behalf of the listener, because I am being deprived of potentially interesting arguments if such people are prohibited from speaking. And stepping slightly away from the platforming, deplatforming debate and going a bit closer to just the value of contrarians, I found in my own life that they tend to fall in two camps. They tend to fall either in their absolute quacks and loons camp, like Spencer's or the Alex Jones flat earther types, where they're saying things that are contrarian, and within about 10 seconds, you can tell that they just are out to lunch. Or they fall in the Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Christopher Hitchens, Christine Hoff Sommers, Alex Epstein, Matt Ridley, Bjorn Lomborg is another one. People who are saying things that are quite against the orthodox, but who have very interesting arguments and who are almost motivated to seek out research that I wouldn't have sought out myself, because they've noticed something in the public conversation that is, say, wrong, and through some innate, say, tendency or perhaps a disagreeable disposition, they are like obsessed with trying to upset the status quo. And such people are the most valuable sources of new information that I've ever come across. And so contrarians, like, they're always worth investigating, because they're either quacks, and you can quickly pretty much find that out. Like, it's not hard when someone starts talking about like flying lizard men or whatever the hell Alex Jones talks about. Or they're disagreeable sometimes, but well-researched and are disrupting the status quo because they have interesting things to say. And so as just simply a tool for learning, I found them to be invaluable.
Yeah, that's worth emphasizing, I think. Like, even if the ideas are wrong, what they allow you to do is spot potential holes in your own values or your own arguments that you can then begin to try and investigate. And that in and of itself is valuable. So even if they're wrong, right, if they're pointing out flaws in your method of reasoning or something, that in itself is very useful for even in just tightening up your own arguments.
Talking about like theses that haven't been perfectly developed, here's one on my side. So look for holes in the reasoning, please. If you think about a lot of the things that you believe in, like fundamental things like the periodic table of elements, or that the Earth is round or approximating round, things like an oblate spheroid. So if I ever want to be really annoying at parties, I say it's not round, it's an oblate spheroid.
Right, yeah.
But the beliefs that we hold tend to either be held because they're true or because other people around us believe them, or some mixture of both. And ideas spread from mind to mind because they're usually either true or useful, or if they propagate by disabling your critical faculties.
Right.
So if it turns off your ability to think critically, then it can also propagate. Okay, so let's just take that as tentatively true. Then the contrarian is useful because they will force you to examine the beliefs that you hold in order to see if it's true or useful, or if it's one of those beliefs that you're just kind of mindlessly passing on. And so the contrarian voice, like if someone says to me, like, how do you actually know that the Earth is round? And if I had to defend myself there, I would probably come up with some pretty shitty arguments. Like, I would say, like, well, you could see, like, satellite images and stuff. But if I actually needed to know this, I would go into, like, the physics literature to see, like, what the best explanations for that are. And right now, I don't have them because I haven't been provoked enough to need them. And so to take away this voice, say, like, so Christina Hoff Sommers was quite influential in my thinking about third wave and second wave feminism. And she made me realize that a lot of the views I held on third wave feminism were needing to be challenged. And so when met with a lot of what she said, I realized I didn't have a good response to her. Same with actually Sam Harris and his views on free will, which was quite transformative in my thinking as well, which is like, I think I have free will. But when someone comes around and tells me I don't, And then I have to come up with reasons and explanations as to why I do. And then I realize I can't easily do that. Then you can start to tease out which of these views that you hold you're really just holding because everyone around you holds. Mm. And I would hazard a guess that many of the views that we all hold are simply just held because people around us hold them too. And so in that way, it's just another example of like why contrarianism is so valuable, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's you're using contrarians to solve the problem of when to rely on expert opinion.
Yeah, nice.
Right. Because nice. Which is fascinating, right? It's a nice heuristic because you can't go around verifying every claim. Obviously that's impossible. We've generated far too much knowledge at one point. You can't become an expert in every field in order to verify every single claim that's being made. And so the default position maybe is to just agree with the majority opinion or expert opinion, depending on the field. But when there's a contrarian voice, it indicates to you that perhaps not is all as it seems. Perhaps it's not all as simple. And that gives you a reason to investigate a little further, right? And which is incredibly valuable because you can't possibly, if there were no contrarian voices for any fields, which ones are you supposed to investigate further? You have no idea, right? Do you investigate the physics literature about gamma ray bursts or general relativity? Do you investigate the political science literature about the values of democracy and the history of tyranny and whatnot, right? Like, you have no idea, but as soon as there are contrarian voices, it's a signal, to indicate to you what other information might be there. So that's a fascinating use of like when to rely on tradition, when to rely on expert opinion, when to start investigating for yourself.
I just got fucking shivers, man. That's such a great unification of a lot of these things I was confused about because I think a couple episodes ago, in the traditions one, you quite rightly challenged what I was saying about experts because I didn't like this use of the expert as a way to defer put an authority figure into your argument. And so I was too strongly against that. And you commented that like, dude, you can't just investigate everything. There's just too much to investigate. So you need some heuristic. And that was an excellent point. But I didn't tie that to the use of contrarians as the signal and the noise as to when you should say, no, I need to take this responsibility upon myself to investigate further. Excellent. Yeah, that was a great, great insight to tie a couple things I was confused about into one coherent view. And so, yeah, thanks. I have no response, just a hearty thank you for that.
I will take it.
That was good.
So, yeah, hearkening back to the thesis that I was mentioning at the beginning. So, I identified I think I identified, perhaps I'm flattering myself, but some core strands of thought between the right and the left. I'm also, because, I'm pretty heavily involved in the EA community, beginning to also recognize these kind of strands in the existential risk type thinking. And so this is also, and this manifests itself as like a fear of technological development, because who knows what sort of problems this could bring, and because we can't foresee it, and possibly it could be so bad it could wipe out humanity, therefore we should stop it and be very, very careful about how we proceed. And so this isn't as much in line, I guess, with the reactionary thesis, but it is a little bit, right? Like it's this distrust of progress, right? Of like this, it's a distrust of the current institutions that are in charge of guiding progress, right? So thinking that we're ill-equipped as it is right now to handle moving forward in the best way possible. Like, we don't have the infrastructure in place to be able to deal with progress, and therefore we should be very skeptical. And to make this concrete, like, skeptical of like AI is one of the, the best, or one of the most influential arguments in the EA community, right? Like, we need to be very skeptical of this new technology. And so this also has it's got a brand of reactionary-ism. Reactionary-ism?
Is
that a thing?
Right?
Where you're just like, you're very afraid of moving forward with some technology. So even among sort of, EA tends to be like very analytical in their thinking, slightly technocratic, like this kind of thinking. There's even this tendency.
I totally agree. Obviously, since this has been one of the big themes of our conversation so far. But if the thesis that like This isn't about left and right so much as it is about just human nature. And this is something that we're going to see in many different guises, like outside the United States and in politics across the world. I think there's probably some truth to that. Then, of course, it's going to manifest itself in the existential risk community. It's going to manifest itself in most communities. I think that there's like twin tendencies. One is a longing for the past, and the other is a fear of the future. And these twin tendencies tend to be present in all sorts of writing and in many different guises. I think Popper somewhere says that it's like humankind's oldest longing, which is a longing to be able to see into the future. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And that's not in this essay, but in one of his writings, he talks about how you can see this in astrology, not astronomy, but astrology, where astronomy is the first science to be successful at making predictions, say solar eclipses and stuff. And that's because it's dealing with a very special, unique physical system, and that's one that reoccurs cyclically, right? So it's easy to make predictions in that domain. And in fact, the fact that we can make predictions in that domain, we can predict when, say, Halley's Comet's going to come back, gives us a desire to be able to do that in every other domain as well, where we can't make predictions. And astrology ties the predictive force of celestial bodies to predictions of your life success, right? So astrology is ties the ability to make predictions to a desire to be able to predict everything.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting thesis. And so we all want to do this. And the fact that we can't, I think, is an internal frustration. And it's one that is always, there's this gap between what we want to do and what we're able to do. And as it creates a vacuum. And I think into this vacuum rushes fear, fear and uncertainty. And so in the existential risk community, yeah, the fear is mainly about AI, and it's mainly about, although Ord and people talk about the other existential risks, volcanoes, earthquakes, synthetic biology and stuff. Although they talk about that, it seems that the conversation is dominated by AI. That seems to be the big one. And that's precisely the one which we're most uncertain about, which we have very little information about, unlike weapons and nukes and all that. And so it makes sense that the thing which we want to do, predict the future, that we can't do, predict the future, is then going to be replaced with fear and a desire to just slow down the future. Let's just slow it down because we're terrified about what's going to come. And so this is an all too human tendency. It's one that will forever be with us. But it's one that we should be very aware of in ourselves, because I think it is just a fallacy. The future is what we make of it. The future isn't determined. It's not inevitable. It is our it's the aggregation of our actions. And so the future is what we do with it. It shouldn't be feared, nor should it be seen as something which we're heading into. It's something which we're making for ourselves. This is my speculation. Obviously, I can't prove anything that I've said, but it's a speculation as to why this tendency seems to keep recurring.
Yeah, interesting. Are you then pretty skeptical of any argument in favor of technological slowdown?
Yes, 100%.
Like,
yeah,
do you view this as...
Absolutely, I am. Yeah. I think that technology is just the application of thinking to problem solving. So I don't even know what people mean by technological slowdown. If by that they mean slowing down solving problems, then that is almost by definition a terrible idea. Like, technology is what we produce as a means of trying to solve problems which present themselves to us. And so even if the problem is, say, boredom, and the solution is video games, it's still a solution to stuff. And technology that just produces, say, like recreational activities and stuff is still solving some problem. Yeah, anything that would suggest technological slowdown, I think, just misunderstands what technology is, and misattributes problems to technology. Like, the reason we have problem X, Y, and Z is because of technology. Well, that's true in many cases, but the problems X, Y, and Z are much better than the problems that the technology was invented to solve. Right. So it's always a question of replacing problems with better problems, where better can mean either more interesting or it can mean less destructive. But yes, 100%, I am not skeptical, but like actively think it's false to want to slow down technology and progress. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded of a passage, I think in David Deutsch's book, where as a young physicist, he's sitting in a lecture and there's some public intellectual who's enumerating all the problems that humanity is facing, overpopulation, lack of food, pollution, garbage disposal, you name it, and saying, you know, there's no way we're making it past the next century or even the next 20 years because of all these problems. And he describes that, you know, some girl raises her hand in the lecture, some fellow student, and asks, you know, like, couldn't we solve some of these problems, right? And he said, what do you mean? Like, you think we're just going to solve all these problems?
Yeah,
like,
you're
just going to pull solutions out of a hat or something? Like, what do you think? And then David Deutsch, describing himself, says, oh, it was at that point he had, you know, been sitting through this lecture quite terrified because this person's telling him the world's going to come to an end and there's thousands of problems they need to solve. And then he realized, wait, this person's thesis is predicated on the fact that we're not going to make any progress, right? The whole point of progress is that we just replace problems with other problems. We don't, there's never just going to be a stop all solution where we see all problems vanish. The whole point is that we have a problem now. We replace it with something that because we can't foresee the future, that inevitably will give rise to problems, and then we tackle those problems.
I am very skeptical. How do I explain this? Long-termism and this like view of like what we should do now to save people 500, 5,000, 5 billion years hence seems just so unbelievably misguided to me, because it is presupposing that the best problem-solving technology that we have is in the current moment, and that people 5,000 years from now won't have infinitely better tools to solve their own problems. And so we should make changes, and we should do things like stopping artificial intelligence. Correct me if I'm conflating two communities and they don't actually say this, but stopping artificial intelligence because we need to be conscious of people 5,000 years from now, rather than saying, all we can do is locally try to improve the world, the world by solving problems and
locally in time. You mean?
Locally in time, and doing so obviously with some awareness that, say, like if you solve a problem by just creating a huge number of problems like 5 years from now, that's not a good idea. So guided by common sense and reason. All we can do is keep trying to push forward into the future, right, cautiously, incrementally, and trust that our grandchildren will continue to do the same. I don't know how what you just said squares with, say, a lot of the long-termist views, which I think in like one of our first or second episodes we talked about. And so I guess I want to put that to you as a question. How do you square that with some of your views on long-termism?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, as you know, my views are in constant evolution because of your criticism. So I'm in constant state of existential crisis as I try and figure out what the fuck my values are and what to do with my life. But I mean, I think there's this coupling of several aspects of long-termism that don't necessarily need to be coupled. And I think that's creating a lot of confusion. So okay. I think there's just the general take that, like, should we care about people in the future, right? And I think my answer to that is still, like, yes. So there's, like, I think Derek Parfit is the biggest proponent of this view and developed several very brilliant thought experiments in his book Reasons and Persons that that helped convince me that the welfare of people in the future should be a concern of mine. But then there's a question which is somewhat independent of, like, what do you do about that? And can you do anything about that? Or, like, what's the best thing to do about that, right? So there's the question of, like, whether you should care and then what you can do about it. And yes. I think these have been coupled in the X-Risk EA communities, right? Where you say, yes, we should care, and therefore we're going to dedicate all our resources towards that problem. regardless of like how much we know about it. So like, even if there's a huge amount of uncertainty, you know, there could be so many people in the future that we're gonna dedicate all our resources and problem solving abilities towards that area. But you could also just take, I think what I'm now leaning towards is like just the acknowledgement of like, yes, I do care about people in the future, but I'm so clueless as to know how to like affect their well-being. And in fact, actually the best thing I could probably do to affect their well-being is solve problems, as you say, locally in time right now, and also encourage just problem solving as a societal mechanism so that when we pass the buck on to them, they are also capable of solving problems, right? So just not destroying the problem-solving mechanism that is so valuable.
Yeah. Oh, there's a really interesting way, I think, to unify these two. So I love the distinction between, yes, I care, but that doesn't immediately translate into action. I don't know if it was Deutsch or Popper or somebody else who said that the best way to do this is to produce and preserve as much knowledge as possible. Because the best thing we can do for the future generations is give them as much knowledge to work with as possible. So we want to do things like, write books, read books, produce research, produce conversations like this, keep thinking, keep trying to add on to this tradition of criticism, but also knowledge accumulation, because what we do know confidently is that to solve problems, you need knowledge about the problem. This is one thing that we do know. And Deutsch's thesis that all evil is due to lack of knowledge indicates that the best way to help future generations is to contribute to this knowledge accumulation. And so in that way, I think that maybe unifies is too strong, but it at least is a way to care about people in the future and act in a way that will benefit them the best we know how, which is to produce knowledge, basically, because we can't know what problems they are going to have. And like, I think at one point I used like the horse dung example, which is that to try to help deal with the horse dung problem is not super useful because the solution turned out to be some entirely new thing, which was cars. And so if you produce knowledge that can, say, lead to the car, but we don't know in advance what it's going to lead to, all we do know is that producing knowledge is going to lead somewhere. That is maybe a way to take the concern and channel it into action.
Yeah, that's nice. But yeah, that also highlights a weird paradox in the, I think, AI safety community, which is that you're trying to solve a problem before you fully know what the problem is, right? So we have this AI development that we're scared of, but we don't know how it will manifest itself. We don't know in what form the threat, if any, will take. And so this is a bizarre, very novel way to solve a problem. I've never heard of this problem-solving technique, right? Like you're giving the solutions to the exam before you see the exam. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Before you even know what the exam is going to be. Like you're given just some solutions and maybe a geometry exam or a geology exam and you have no idea.
You're just told that the field is math and then you give your solutions and then they give you the exam. And that seems difficult to do. So, And so perhaps that is a slightly unfair characterization of the view, but I think that is sort of in general how they're going about it, right? They're trying to slow down development and speed up safety of the technology, but without knowing, like, how do you create safe technology for a technology that doesn't yet exist? You don't know how, in what form the technology will exist, right? So if we knew that, then we'd have AI.
No,
I was just going to say, the only rebuttal I see there is like, well, if you believe in like this singularity hypothesis that as soon as you develop the first thing that's truly AI, then you just have this exponential takeoff of intelligence where it proves upon itself exponentially. And so within, I don't know, 15 seconds, it's just a master of the planet. So if you think that is the best explanation for how AI is going to progress, then I can understand there is a bit of a tension here, right? You can't wait for that to develop before you develop the safety for it. But I think there's still uncertainty
I think that leads, if you think that, I haven't considered this before, but if you think that, that leads almost immediately to reactionary tendencies because the best way to keep things safe is to prevent it from happening, right? And to prevent it from happening is to just slow down and stop technology. And then that basically leads us back to where you had began, which is the even the Bay Area rationalist community that just cares about improving the planet and is like, I don't even think of them as on the far left, the far right. They're almost like just their own group. But even their reactionary tendencies tend to emerge through different arguments, through philosophy, through a whole different set of thinkers and authors. But still, you get the same conclusion, which is we need to stop progress. And that is the surefire way to cause more problems and cause a lot of the things which we're both rightly trying to prevent.
Nice, man. I don't have much more than that. Pretty epic line to close with.
Yeah, exactly. Well, interesting. So, cool. Yeah, let's just pick it up. I don't know what we're going to talk about next time with the Conjecture and Refutation series, but nice place to end it. And yeah, that's fine.